Coming up, the settlement issue in Middle East peace talks. Also, the three remaining Shakers trying to build heaven on earth.
The whole idea is to live the kingdom life here and now.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Another historic event for Pope Benedict XVI this week, his four-day trip to the United Kingdom, the first official state visit there by any pope. King Henry VIII broke ties with the Roman Catholic Church almost 500 years ago. As Kim Lawton reports, Benedict's trip has not been without controversy.
Pope Benedict went to the UK at the invitation of Queen Elizabeth II, who is also the official head of the Church of England. The only other pope to visit Britain was John Paul II, who made what was billed a pastoral pilgrimage in 1982. John Paul was greeted with an outpouring of affection, but Benedict has faced tensions and even outright protest. One major issue is outrage over the clergy sex abuse crisis still swirling across many parts of Europe. At the beginning of the trip, Benedict admitted the church was, quote, not sufficiently vigilant, quick, and decisive to take the necessary measures to combat the crisis. Another difficult issue is relations between Roman Catholics and the Anglican Communion, whose spiritual head, the Archbishop of Canterbury, is based in Britain. Last October, the Vatican made it easier for disaffected Anglicans to become Catholics. A highlight of Benedict's trip is the beatification of the 19th century scholar and writer Cardinal John Henry Newman, a convert from Anglicanism. But perhaps the biggest challenge has been making the case for faith in a nation known for its growing secularism. Throughout the trip, Benedict called for a return to the traditional values and cultural expressions of Christianity.
And Kim, this trip to Britain is part of the Pope's overall effort to try to roll back the trend to secularism all over Europe. No easy task.
It's a big task, and one that he's very concerned about. He has been throughout his papacy. He just created a new department in the Vatican to focus on doing that. And in many ways, Britain was a real test case or a real case study about this growing secularism. There were some new polling released with the visit that showed that 60% of British people say they never go to church, 42% say they don't belong to any religion, and almost 20% said they're sure there is no God. So that was a big task for him to try to make a case that Christianity and faith are good for society. Now, his message that he wanted to transmit faced a lot of challenges, one of which was the sex abuse crisis. And a lot of people were saying maybe his moral authority to make the case for religion being a cause for good was in some way compromised by the sex abuse scandal.
And also there's some fence mending with the Anglican Communion, isn't there?
Well, practically since the time of Henry VIII, there's been talk of trying to get Anglicans and Catholics, these two big bodies of Christians, back together. There are a lot of big issues, and the turmoil within the Anglican Communion over issues like homosexuality has only generated more tension, and so that remains a very big issue for those two Christian groups.
Mm. Kim, many thanks. Here at home, new figures from the U.S. Census Bureau show a rise in the number of Americans living in poverty. According to the latest report, the poverty rate grew to 14.3% last year, up from just over 13% in 2008. In 2009, more than 43.5 million people, or one in seven Americans, lived in poverty. Meanwhile, the United Nations says the number of hungry people around the world has dropped below the 1 billion mark. The UN says lower food prices contributed to the decrease, but that still leaves more than 900 million people who are hungry. Many states held primaries this week in preparation for November's midterm elections. In Washington, religious conservatives rallied their troops at the annual Values Voters Summit. Thousands gathered to hear from a parade of conservative politicians, including several Republican hopefuls for the 2012 presidential race. A major theme of the event was concern about the moral health of the nation. Several Tea Party favorites also spoke. In France, a ban on face-covering veils like the burqa or niqab in public moved another step closer to becoming law. The French Senate voted overwhelmingly in favor of the measure, which was passed earlier this summer by the country's National Assembly. Some lawmakers have asked France's Constitutional Council to review the bill before President Sarkozy can sign it into law. Proponents say the ban protects France's traditions of secularism and equality. Opponents argue that it will isolate Muslim women who choose to cover their faces. Violence continued in several parts of the world this week in response to an American pastor's proposed plans to burn copies of the Quran on September 11th. Although the burning was canceled, thousands still protested in Afghanistan, where several people were killed and many more wounded during successive days of rioting. In Kashmir, police enforced a strict curfew following deadly clashes with protesters who set fire to government buildings and a Christian school. In Jerusalem, with Secretary of State Clinton on hand, the Israeli and Palestinian leaders continued talks aimed at Middle East peace. One of the toughest and most immediate issues is Israeli settlements on land in the West Bank the Palestinians insist is theirs. On September 26th, Israel's self-imposed moratorium on more settlement construction expires, and no one knows whether Israel will then start building again, and if it does, whether the Palestinians will walk out of the talks. Fred DeSam Lazaro visited the dry and windy West Bank.
Gilad Freund has spent much of his adult life here as a farmer, an occupation not commonly associated with his roots in New York City. But as a Jew, Freund says he has his own concept of roots and geography.
I was brought up to believe that the Jewish people have a historical, strong connection with the land of Israel. And even though there's a good life in America, I felt that it was an important step for me to come here.
Freund arrived 30 years ago and settled in the village of Tekoa, about 30 miles from Jerusalem, a place that dates back to biblical times.
Tekoa is the home of the prophet Amos. He was a real farmer, and in the book of Amos, he prophesizes that the people of Israel will come back to the land and that they will settle on the land and they will plant gardens and grow fruit trees. And he used these biblical agricultural analogies in his prophecy.
Gilad Freund embodies not just that prophecy, but also the Zionist vision of a Jewish state that led to the formation of modern-day Israel. Freund is among at least 300,000 Israelis who've settled on the West Bank, land captured by Israel in the 1967 war. They are drawn by religious conviction or often by just the affordable, subsidized housing. The settlements have long been a sticking point in peace negotiations. They've angered not just Palestinians, but also settlers themselves, when Israel has agreed to dismantle some of them, like those in Gaza in 2005. The Gaza Strip and much of the West Bank are areas of Palestinian self-rule. In a two-state solution, they would roughly form the State of Palestine. But for many Arabs living here, the concerns are more immediate and day-to-day. In the sparse village outside the city of Hebron, residents complained about the lack of proper roads, electricity, and water. And things have gotten a lot worse, they say, as they became surrounded by Israeli settlements.
Before settlements, the range for our animals was very large. There used to be a lot of grazing land, a lot of water. Now, because of the settlements, we're restricted from grazing, and we cannot access the cisterns.
These village women complained of raids by Israeli security forces, who they say accused them of harboring illegal Palestinian migrant laborers or terrorists on their way to Israel.
They try to intimidate us. They come at night, make trouble for our young people. They don't have title to this land. They don't have the right to take our land and prevent us from having access to any part of this area.
Across the rural West Bank, complaints were common about intimidation and vandalism. The settlers' response was difficult to get. Settlers are reticent, suspicious of outsiders, and they've long complained of a perpetual terrorist threat. What is not in question is the stark gap in the standard of living between Palestinians and settlers, a gap vividly evident in the fields. Israeli farmers enjoy water at subsidized rates. Palestinian farmers do not.
If you look around us, we will see that the Palestinian land is totally bare now. There is no farming here because there is no water. And also this has been very much affected by the Israeli control of the water. And next to us here we can see a big farm owned by one Israeli settler who's taking the water from a well, while the Palestinians have no access or right to dig any new well to tap the groundwater.
Nader Al-Khatib and Gideon Bromberg belong to Friends of the Earth Middle East, an environmental group with Israeli, Palestinian, and Jordanian members.
Shared water resources are not being shared fairly. That's critical to the peace process. That's critical as an issue that creates animosity between Palestinians and Israelis. And we believe that this is not fair, this is not just, this is not sustainable.
Even as they criticize what they call discriminatory Israeli policies, both men agree the Palestinians also suffer from internal problems, corruption, mismanagement, and a bloody leadership struggle that has divided the Palestinian territories. On the other hand, settlements have been largely well served with roads, water, and security under successive Israeli governments, whether left-leaning or right, whether the communities were officially sanctioned or built without government approval by private or religious organizations. One of the settlers' strongest allies is Israel's Minister of Infrastructure. He's with the nationalist Yisrael Beitenu party, a coalition partner in the government, though his views sound far more strident than official government pronouncements. Uzi Landau refers to the West Bank by its biblical name, Judea and Samaria, and says it's an integral part of the Jewish homeland.
You've been quoted as calling Arabs the occupiers. Is that an accurate quote, and what did you mean?
It is an absolutely accurate description. They are modern crusaders. This land has been always our land. This land, so many occupiers. Jews were driven out, many of them, during the Roman period. They saw the Iranians, the Farsi, they saw the Ottomans, they saw the Arabs, they saw the British, the Mamluks, you name it. Every occupier replaced the one and was replaced by the occupier that came after him. The Arabs are one of the occupiers. They are living over there. They have and should have all the rights as a minority has in every democratic country. But we claim that this is our land, definitely.
We insist that we will stay on this land, even if it means we will die here.
Palestinian farmers we talked to have their own historical starting line.
First, there are Arabs here before the Jews. So we could use the same argument to say the previous generations of our people were here before you. This is not a solution, because we are all sons of Abraham, them and us. We must appreciate each other, because we are cousins.
Settler farmer Gilad Freund says he's grown used to living with the seemingly intractable, often tense dispute over land. But all historic grievances take time to address, he says. Just look at the U.S. and civil rights.
Once segregation ended, it was not overnight that things changes, and there's still a lot of problems today. There's ghettos, there's unemployment, there's a lot of problems today that still have not been solved. So processes take time. Americans like to think that they're overnight solutions. Overnight solutions in Iraq, overnight solutions in Afghanistan. In the Middle East, there are no overnight solutions.
Whether the new peace talks continue seems to depend on some compromise within the family of Abraham. Whether Israel will build settlements after September 26th, and if they do, whether the Palestinians will keep negotiating. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSamlazaro.
On our calendar this week, two Jewish holidays, Yom Kippur, or the Day of Atonement, the most solemn day of the Jewish calendar. Observant Jews spend Saturday in synagogue praying, fasting, and repenting. And this coming week marks the seven-day festival of Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. Jews recall their ancestors' 40 years of wandering in the desert by building a fragile structure called a sukkah, which they use for prayers and meals. Now, a visit with the surviving Shakers, the Christian group known for its devotion to God, demanding lifestyle, beautiful furniture, and joyful songs. Before the Civil War, there were nearly 6,000 Shakers in 23 U.S. communities. Today, there's just one active Shaker village left, with just 3 members. Just above Sabbath Day Lake in central Maine, the last Shaker community straddles an old road in the midst of 1,800 acres of forest and farmland. At its peak, there were nearly 200 members here. Now the 3 remaining are Brother Arnold Hadd, 53. He came here when he was 20. Sister June Carpenter is 72 and too shy for an interview. She's been here for 21 years. And Sister Frances Carr is 83. She was brought here when she was 10.
I hope and I pray with all my heart that we're not the last 3 Shakers.
As long as we do God's work, I believe in the essence of my soul that there will always be vocations sent to this way of life.
Shakers originated in England in the 1700s, an ecstatic offshoot of the more sedate Quakers, led by a charismatic preacher Shakers call Mother Ann Lee. Like today's Pentecostals, Shakers who felt the Holy Spirit would roll and twirl and speak in tongues, shaking Quakers they were called, Shakers. Mother Ann taught that lives devoted to God could best be lived in isolated and disciplined communities in which members would share all they owned, as did the earliest Christians.
It's giving yourself and all that you may possess to God and to the community.
The goal was nothing less than working to become perfect and to achieve salvation and heaven in this life.
It's a prefigurement of the kingdom, and the whole idea is to live the kingdom life here and now. The things that we do, we're not motivated by gain or selfish gain. It's not private. It's not for ourselves. It's for God and for this community. The personal pronouns have to be changed. It's not me, my, and I. It's ours.
So, in the Sabbath Day Lake Cemetery, there are 150 individual graves, but just one all-inclusive marker.
We think of Father, Mother, God, not just as God as a Father.
The Eternal God, our Father and Mother, we thank you for bringing so many good friends.
God is all spirit, and God has the strength of the male and the tenderness and love of the female.
It followed that men and women must be treated equally, but they were strictly separated. Mother Ann thought sex and marriage interfered with devotion to God.
It was to imitate the life of Christ. So we're celibate because Christ was celibate. We live in community because Christ and his disciples lived in community. We're pacifists because Christ was a pacifist.
I asked Brother Arnold how a Shaker deals with celibacy.
You just deal with it. I think that has to come as a gift from God. I really do. You have to be married to Christ. I mean, Christ has to be your lover. It doesn't work any other way. Because you have to feel so attuned to that spirit and so in love with God that it can fill any void that you might have in your life.
Shakers were widely admired for their craftsmanship, such as graceful chairs and other furniture. Also for their 100 or more inventions, such as the flat broom.
Everything that we strive to make, either for our own use or for sale to the world, is done as perfectly as we possibly can.
At Sabbath Day Lake, they grew herbs and sold herbal medicine and seeds. They have 19,000 apple trees, far too many for them to manage, so they rent the orchard out. As an elder, trustee, and spokesman, Brother Arnold has many responsibilities.
Okay, guys, let's go.
He also feeds the sheep and Scottish cattle twice a day.
Our founder, Mother Ann, said, hands to work, hearts to God. So for us, work is worship. If you did something so menial as cleaning a toilet, that can be actually an act of worship, because it's not being done for yourself, but it's being done for God. It's being done for others.
Every summer, members of the Sabbath Day Lake support group Friends of the Shakers come to visit. Brother Arnold and one of the young visitors called the people to Sunday worship. The friends filled the meeting house, women in through one door, men through another, and inside, the genders separated and facing each other. There's no preacher. The elders read scripture and comment on it.
If we turn to that love of God, there is hope for each one of us this morning.
And then came the singing.
Sisters, ain't you happy, followers of the Lamb?
Shakers are said to have 10,000 songs, of which the most famous is Simple Gifts.
Tis a gift to be simple, tis a gift to be free, tis a gift to come down where we ought to be.
And then came Voluntary Testimony.
So that's what I want to do, is every day, is seek that Spirit of God.
While each person spoke, one of the elders chose a song that complemented what was being said.
Mother has come with her beautiful song.
Ho, ho, tally-ho.
And then another testimony.
We can find God in an everyday life and in a continuing life in community. It's lived out every day here, and it can be lived out every day in our lives.
In many ways, Shakerism has been the victim of progress. The Industrial Revolution lured away many young men, and Shaker craftsmen could not compete with mass production. The states began looking after orphans, which Shakers had done, hoping they would become members as adults. More recently, changing attitudes towards sex made the celibacy requirement for many an insurmountable obstacle. But Shakers say for those who actually try the life, celibacy is not the biggest problem.
Usually those who have been here and have left have found it too regimented.
Obedience, that's the, yeah. And she's absolutely right. I think almost no one's left for any other reasons.
The obedience was a greater problem than celibacy?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I wouldn't have been here all my life if I didn't love this life. But I can't say that it has been a heaven on earth. I can't say that there aren't days when woo-hoo. It's far from heaven.
I'm not a fool to think that it is, but the concept, the whole life is to live the heavenly life.
As much as possible.
And as we've also been told, you know, to make it as little hellish as possible for everybody else. Yeah. When I was a young believer, I had a problem with somebody in the community, and my elder told me, I said, I just can't love them. I just don't like them. And he said, well, that's your problem. You don't have to like anybody. You just have to love everyone. That is probably the greatest advice I've ever had in my whole life.
I asked Sister Frances about the Friends of the Shakers. Might some of them become converts?
Well, they are very good friends and are in with us in many ways spiritually. They're not about to give up their husband, their wife, or their homes and come and live in community.
Meanwhile, the Shakers themselves don't want to change any rules to attract converts.
They come and they try the life, and usually it is on our decision that they don't remain. We don't want it to continue in any way that has been diluted from what we have lived. In our morning prayers, and each of us take a turn leading the prayers, Brother Ronald says something about the thousands who are going to be coming here.
Well, that's my hope. And I don't see why not. God did it once before. I don't know why God can't do it again.
I asked Brother Arnold about the Shaker legacy.
Well, I think that what Shakerism has proved to the world is that it is possible to live the fullness of the Christ life here and now, to really start making that heaven on earth. It has taken some very ordinary people and has allowed them to live extraordinary lives.
Turn, turn, 'twill be our new life, till by
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. There's much more on our website, including more of my interviews with the Shakers. You can comment on all of our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Join us at pbs.org.
Come, little children, come to Zion.
As we leave you, more singing from the Shaker meeting at Sabbath Day Lake, Maine.
Come, little children, march along. Come, little children, come to Zion. Come, little children, march along. Come, little children, come to Zion. Come, little children, march along. And your clothing and your dress shall be the robe of righteousness. And your clothing and your dress shall be the robe of righteousness.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.